We simply cannot allow people to pour into the United States undetected, undocumented, unchecked.
And complete the dang fence.
This bill that we will sign today is not a revolutionary bill.
Cast down your bucket where you are.
We come from France.
And I am, adamantly against illegal immigrants.
They're coming in by the thousands. Just unbelievable.
A wall is an immorality.
Who are you rooting for?
Those masters of the universe are at it again.
You maniac! You blew it up!
Welcome to Parsing Immigration Policy. This is Jessica Vaughn. I'm Director of Policy Studies at the Center for Immigration Studies, filling in for Mark Krikorian this week. I am pleased to introduce Steve Robinson, my guest this week. Steve is editor-in-chief of The Maine Wire, which is a digital media outlet covering Maine. They've been around since 2011, doing outstanding investigative journalism and commentary on Maine. I met Steve when he was executive producer for The Howie Carr Show, and he has also done producing for Barstool Sports, in particular, an excellent podcast called The Case, which investigates a cold case of a murder of a Massachusetts woman many years ago. So, Steve, it's great to talk with you.
Thank you very much for having me, Jessica.
Thanks for coming on. The topic of our conversation this week is something that you have been covering very thoroughly for the last few months now, and that's an investigation of the proliferation of illegal weed grows in rural Maine and other places around the country that are operated by Chinese transnational criminal organizations. You've called your series, which is on your website, themainwire.com, Triad Weed. So what led you to this story, Steve?
My investigation started when an immigration reporter, Jenny Tarr, who is now with the New York Post, published a memo that had been leaked from the Department of Homeland Security, from Customs and Border Protection, that said that there were, I think, over 800 locations, properties in the United States that were owned by transnational criminal organizations and that were being used to grow marijuana illegally. And then the proceeds of those operations were being used to fund fentanyl trafficking, human trafficking, and some of the money was being funneled back to the People's Republic of China to fund other activities of the Chinese Communist Party. And what really caught my eye in the memo was that it said specifically more than 270 of these sites were in the state of Maine. And I grew up in central Maine. I went to college in Maine. I've lived in New England most of my life. And I'd heard rumors about this kind of activity, but the eye-popping number of 270 locations, my first instinct was, oh, they've got to be easy to find if there's 270 of them. Somebody has to know about this activity. So I began making phone calls to some of my high school buddies, actually, who work in the electrical industry, and just to say, hey, is this just a tabloid story, or is there something real here? What's going on? And they said, oh yeah, this is a huge problem. Just in my hometown, there were 7 of these locations.
Right there and almost in plain sight, and nobody, really doing anything or noticing. I guess people notice, but really some serious implications. Go ahead.
Well, I think people noticed the individual sites. They would notice when their new neighbors moved in who didn't speak English or didn't mow their lawn and suddenly the house starts to smell like a skunk. They would notice the individual ones, but it really took an effort to track down and identify and photograph and research the ownership structure of all of the properties to show that this wasn't just a few isolated incidents of migrants or new Americans coming here and trying to live the American dream with their green thumb. It took that effort to really show that this is a combination of sophisticated criminal networks that are working together with combined funding, supply chains, different security practices, different money laundering strategies. It took showing in that it was a network, I think, for the people of Maine to grasp the scale, scope, nature, severity of the problem.
You have a lot of pictures of some of these sites in the stories, and they just look like regular farmhouses or ranch houses. How can you tell that these are illegal weed grow houses from the outside?
My investigation started, again, with, talking with some of my friends in the area who confirmed that this is a very real thing that's going on all over the state. So I wanted to follow up on it, and I made contact with Jenny from, who at the time was working for the Daily Caller News Foundation, and invited her to come up to Maine and said, hey, I'll, you know, we can go around and we can knock on some doors and we can find out what's going on. Because in addition to what she had published publicly, which was the memo describing the situation here in Maine, she also had obtained a list of some addresses that the Homeland Security thought were part of this network. So we went to work pulling the deed and the sale and the mortgage documents related to those specific properties to try to contact the owners, at the very least to call them up and say, hey, did you know you're on a Homeland Security watch list as a suspected member of a transnational criminal organization? Attempts to contact them were unsuccessful, but we were able to visit those properties. And we learned a couple of things through that research and through visiting the properties. The first was that there was a bank that kept showing up as being involved in a lot of mortgages for these properties. Mm-hmm. And that's called Quantic Bank out of New York. And just a quirk of how you can search property records in the state of Maine is you can do it by the owner's name, but you can also do it by the name of the mortgage company. So when I just plugged in Quantic Bank into all 16 counties in the state, lo and behold, this is a bank that has done just a handful of mortgages in the state of Maine until 2020. And after 2020, they start doing several dozen a year, more than 80 we found so far. And all of them happen to be for individuals who are of Asian descent or from Brooklyn or Malden, Mass, or some of the other locations that are frequently associated with Asian transnational organized crime. And so a pattern developed there that was very interesting. But we also noticed when we physically inspected some of these properties that they all had a couple, some equipment, some infrastructure upgrades that are associated with legal marijuana grows. And the biggest one in particular was an increased electrical service. A 400 amp service is pretty much the standard for a lot of these marijuana grows. Now, most residential homes in Maine for years probably got away with a 50 amp service. The majority, I would say, have a 100 amp service. If you get a new one installed these days, you probably go to a 200 amp in case you're looking to get a heat pump installed or maybe run a hot tub or something. But a 400 amp service is technically commercial grade electricity. It's a very serious amount of electricity. It's the kind of power you have if you're running a grocery store and you need to keep a bunch of refrigerators running all the time. You know, no run-of-the-mill residential customer is having that much power. And one of the quirks, again, of public records is that if you install that amount of power, 400 amps, to a residential property, it requires a state inspection. And because it requires a state inspection, there's a public record that I was able to obtain. So I, through the Electrical Examiner's Board, was able to obtain a list of all of the commercial grade power entrances that had been installed in the state of Maine from 2016 until the date that I requested them. And that ended up being a roadmap to basically everywhere in the state where marijuana is being grown, both legally and illegally. I guess one of the reasons why these spaces need so much power is not just because of the lights and the water pumps. It's because you need to have temperature regulation pretty much 24/7. So you need to be able to control the humidity, keep it low, and also control the temperature, because the ideal temperature for growing marijuana is about 75 degrees. The lights generate heat, so you'll scorch your plants if you don't have multiple heat pumps running to cool the place. So they're heating it up with the lights and cooling it with the heat pumps that they've installed, and all of that consumes a huge amount of electricity, but it's also visible from the exterior of the property. You can see these heat pumps just festooning the sides of these properties in a way that no Mainer who cared about the appearance of their home would actually have them installed. And you can see shiny brand new 400 amp service panels installed alongside it. And most of the time when you visit them, you can smell the pot. And then you could just go talk to the neighbors and ask them, hey, what's going on with your neighbors over there? And, you know, 9 times out of 10, they've complained to the local cops, the sheriff, they've written to their senator or their congressperson because they're concerned with what's going on.
And how did the Department of Homeland Security come to the conclusion that these were actually illegal grows? Were they not licensed in the state of Maine?
That's a very important question. And it gets into one of the, I guess, one of the reasons why this network was allowed to proliferate in the state of Maine. And one of the reasons why it's been so difficult for law enforcement to do anything about the network as it's grown. The Department of Homeland Security says that they used basically the same tools I did, open source records, which I took to believe tax records, registry of deeds records, that kinds of thing. But they also said that they accessed federal databases, which I'm not sure exactly what that is. I know in some instances there was some physical surveillance done of some of these properties, but I'm not sure the extent of that. But the way you identify that these sites are illegal is through a combination of factors. One is that Maine voted in a ballot referenda in 2016 to legalize the adult use and recreational sale of marijuana. We'd already had a medical marijuana program. It took until 2020 for the state to craft legislation that articulated how a business could go about cultivating, manufacturing, and selling marijuana. So right at 2020, all of the legal marijuana businesses begin to take off. And that's also when you see the transnational criminal organizations come in and begin snapping up properties and kind of joining the fun. The legislation allowed municipalities to either opt in or opt out of the adult use recreational program. Like my hometown, for example, Dexter opted out. So there shouldn't be any marijuana grown or sold in the town of Dexter. Yet there are 7 grows where there very obviously are large amounts of marijuana being grown. And so there's a lot of towns there where based on a municipal ordinance or the fact that they opted out, you know that marijuana shouldn't be cultivated there. It's also a matter of scale. The state regulates the adult use recreational side by tier 1, 2, 3, 4, according to how many plants you can grow. And a tier 1 grow or a simple medicinal grow is going to be like 35 plants or 500 square feet of canopy. And most often, you're not going to really be able to smell that. And a lot of the licensed ones are actually required to have activated charcoal air filter systems so that they don't become a nuisance to their neighbors. And a lot of them do it just as a matter of best practices. So the ones that are really, really obvious just to smell and that bother the neighbors are more likely to be illegal as well. Mm-hmm. But one of the tricky things, though, is that it doesn't make sense at first, but the adult use recreational side of Maine's marijuana market is far more regulated than the medicinal side. And it's a smaller market. So the adult use recreational side in the most recent year, I think, accounted for somewhere around 230 or 250 million in taxable revenues. And the medicinal side was between 300 and 350 million. On the adult use side, if you go into a dispensary and you're 21 years old and you want to buy a joint, the joint has a barcode on it that technically should allow a regulator to trace that joint back to not just the license that it was grown under, but the facility where it was grown and the room in that facility where it was grown and when. It's called seed to sale tracking. And it's a very high regulatory burden that these companies have to meet. And they also have to do testing on their products for microbials, heavy metals, pesticides, fungicides, any of the bad stuff that you wouldn't want in your food or in your cannabis. On the medicinal side, there is none of that. there's no seed to sale tracking. Exactly. And it's no surprise then that also, you know, every company or government effort at testing a wide batch of samples has found that, hey, there are more contaminants and, pesticides and fungicides on the medicinal side. But what the state did when they created this program was, one, they made it very hard to determine for local law enforcement, county law enforcement, made it very hard for them to determine whether or not a site was licensed. So they could know that this place is growing a huge amount of weed and that it doesn't look like a professional setup and no one's ever been able to buy weed off them. It looks very unusual, but they have to go to the Office of Cannabis Policy and go through a process of trying to pull the records because it's medicinal and everything's protected under HIPAA. So if you're a medicinal grower, you have added layers of privacy and protection. So we created this kind of overly bureaucratic parallel system with the corporate regulated side on the adult use side. But the medicinal side is, it's been described to me over and over again as just the wild, wild west of Maine's marijuana markets, both on the, for the, you know, American and Maine native operators, but also for the transnational criminal organizations. So establishing that the sites are in fact illegal ultimately becomes the domain of the law enforcement, because they're the only ones that OCP will say, this place isn't licensed. Like OCP, we asked for a list of licensed sites from OCP and they won't turn that over. The rationale for that is, well, you know, if you tell everyone where the pot's being grown, I guess these places will be robbed. But it creates a very, very difficult system, both for journalistically, but also from a law enforcement perspective to investigate.
So where was this weed being grown in these sites likely ending up? In the medicinal market or on the street? But probably not in the legal recreational marketplace.
None of it was ending up in the adult use recreational market. The assistant attorney general who testified on a related bill earlier this year said that they do believe that some of this marijuana has been making its way into the medicinal side. And that would align with what I've heard from licensed growers, legal cannabis business operators. Because if you have someone who is part of your criminal organization who obtains a medicinal growing card, and we've identified some of these people, but if you have that card, then you can technically grow an unlimited amount of weed and go around and wholesale it to other medicinal dispensaries. So that created an avenue for marijuana grown at any of these locations to be diverted into the medicinal program. So say an individual goes to various sites all across the state that are operating without a license, he picks up trash bags full of weed, and then he brings them to medical dispensaries that are operating as licensed businesses, and he says, hey, this all came from my licensed grow at this location, and I can give it to you for $500 a pound, when the prevailing price for legitimate operators is over $2,000 a pound or over $1,600 a pound. So, you know, we're in the middle of government lockdowns. Times are tough. You know, this is still the pandemic. You got to put bread on the table. You know, you got to feed your kids. You're going to take a deal, even if it looks kind of sketchy. So at least some of the marijuana grown at these sites in Maine was being diverted into the medicinal market. But the majority of it was being trafficked out of state, because as this operation was spinning up, New York still had a black market, and they've since legalized, but they've had some trouble bringing their regulated system online. So there's still a pretty strong gray market there, but ditto for Massachusetts. Yeah. So the weed is basically being exported out of the state to states where there are black and gray markets, and you can get a premium on it. So the price for like a gram of marijuana in Maine right now is somewhere around $7. It used to be earlier in the program, $15 or $16, but you can triple that if you just have some guy drive it in a U-Haul to New York or Massachusetts or the American Southeast or really any of the states where marijuana is still prohibited.
So have there been some estimates as to how much revenue these sites in Maine were generating for the cartel?
Yeah, there have. So in the original memo that was leaked by the Department of Homeland Security, they estimated that it was over $4 billion. I personally think that that's a pretty drastic overestimate because they were basing it on some numbers generated by government bureaucrats, not by pot farmers. And I've talked with a lot of pot farmers and they've all said, nah, there's no way these guys are making that much money. But it is well over $500 million a year, if not in the billions for sure, especially because they're able to get it to states where they can sell it for a black market premium. But they also have an advantage over the legal growers in that they don't have to pay for their electrical work in some cases, because they'll just do it themselves unlicensed. They typically underpay or don't pay at all their laborers, and they're not paying any regulatory fees, licensing fees. They're not paying taxes on the sale of their product because they're not complying with the law. they have huge cost advantages over everyone who's trying to legally do this business. So they're able to, I guess, run a more, they can have higher profit margins on their businesses because they're not following any of the rules, and they're also illegally crossing state lines to sell the product at a premium.
This is kind of the classic illegal alien entrepreneur business model of breaking all kinds of laws that level the playing field and create safe products for Americans, American consumers especially. And that is, you know, where some of the implications to the immigration issue and border security start to come in. And I want to talk about the financing eventually, but let's talk about these workers. You know, do you think they are going to the local unemployment agency to find workers at these places, or, you know, how are they staffing them?
Well, I can tell you, none of them are registered to vote. So they're not, as far as we can tell, they're not even applying for government benefits or EBT cards. They are recruited through a number of means. One that we've found is there's a network of Chinese language websites which post job ads for greenhouse workers or irrigation workers, and in some cases, masseuses, to come up to the state of Maine and work. And they post wages in yen, which are the equivalent of like $16,000 a year. So they're using, you know, WeChat and some of the Chinese apps, but they're also using these Chinese language job boards to help recruit. But there's also, you know, an informal network, a familial network, where they're able to recruit people to come up and grow at these sites. Because Maine is a sanctuary state with lots of sanctuary cities, there is a large degree of hesitancy from law enforcement to investigate, explore, even talk about the immigration status of any of these individuals. But there are some cases where we've been able to determine by investigating court records or talking with law enforcement that the individuals are present here illegally or with asylum claims. In the case of a major bust in Machias, which is in the eastern part of the state, Washington County, one of the most rural parts of the state, there was a massive grow operation there at an old farm that had, I think, 9 or 10 full-on sophisticated grow rooms and well over 3,000 plants. And when law enforcement executed a search warrant on the place, there were three individuals there. Two of them had Malaysian passports. One of them had a Chinese passport. And I think the Chinese passport holder had a New York driver's license. But as you guys know, and New York will give a driver's license to anybody.
Yes.
So having a New York driver's license or a Massachusetts driver's license even is not necessarily evidence that someone is present in the U.S. legally. But the Sheriff Troy Morton in Penobscot County has said that they do believe the majority of the workers at these sites are here either illegally or with defensive asylum claims or some other uncertain immigration status. And I can tell you from my personal experiences with them that there's a very, very low degree of English proficiency, and that could be something that's feigned in order to avoid questioning or play dumb. But all of the individuals who have been arrested throughout the state have required either Cantonese or Mandarin translators throughout their court proceedings. Some court records I was looking at just the other day at a place, ironically, in China, Maine, there was a raid done there, and the ringleader, I guess you could say, admitted to coming into the country illegally, and then later said that he had a green card, and then later said that he had asylum status. And there was an ICE detainer placed on him for removal, and he was brought from the Kennebec County Correctional Facility down to the Cumberland County Correctional Facility in this other part of the state to await deportation proceedings. And his lawyer filed a motion to increase his bail or revoke his bail so that they could bring him from Cumberland back up to Kennebec and help him skip out on deportation because he had that pending asylum claim. And it worked. The state assisted a defense attorney in this elaborate maneuver to help someone who admitted to being an illegal marijuana grower skip out on deportation.
Yeah, there are plenty of sanctuary judges who are willing to play along with that. You know, definite double standards in our justice system sometimes. Change the standards that would be applied so that people can escape the immigration or removal consequences of their crimes. What I have learned from following some of these cases of other illegal cannabis grows in other parts of the country, they're notorious for using trafficked labor. It's very common that the workers in these situations are paying off their smuggling debt through their labor to the criminal organization that's running these operations. And, you know, sometimes they're dealt with violently. They, you know, obviously have no freedom of movement. You know, they're not allowed to be out and about in the community. And, you know, and it's slave labor for the drug cartel.
Yeah, I mean, and that's what we've seen. That's what we've seen in Oklahoma. There was a case where there were some trafficked laborers there who were promised work in a flower cutting business. They didn't realize what kind of flowers they would be cutting. But there was a quadruple homicide out there because for some reason violence erupted. And there's also a massive pending case now where Chinese illegal aliens were trafficked onto Navajo reservation land and forced to work. They had their, you know, their phones, their wallets, everything taken away from them, and were forced to work growing marijuana. There's every reason to believe that something similar is happening up here in Maine. In the raid I was just telling you about in Machias, those individuals said that they'd been making somewhere on the order of $1,000 or $2,000 a month, which is barely minimum wage. Actually, they've increased minimum wage recently, so it might be below minimum wage. So that there's every reason to believe that they're not here under ideal circumstances. It's tough really to prove that someone is a victim of human trafficking because there's a lot of fear. They don't want to admit it. One of the individuals who was arrested in one of the first raids in Carmel, Maine, outside of Bangor, actually told cops, you know, well, none of this really matters because I'm going to be dead soon anyways. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't really clear exactly what he meant by that from the court records. But at least my impression of that was, you know, someone is going to take me out because I've messed up. I've gotten caught and they're going to take care of me. But if you're brought to, say, Kingfield, Maine, which is about 2 hours away from the nearest city, and you don't have a car or an internet connection, and you don't speak the language, you know, you might not be chained to the house and, you know, held at gunpoint to do the marijuana grow, but can you really be said to be free?
And how much of their of a paycheck are they really seeing anyway?
Oh, they don't even touch it. So, yeah. You know, the from what we've been able to establish, talking with law enforcement, talking with neighbors, there's a established pickup schedule that they have calibrated around their growing schedule. So they know when a vehicle is going to arrive, usually a Sprinter van or a, you know, a Ford Transit van or a U-Haul. They know when that van's going to show up and they're ready, they load it and that van's gone. So, you know, they grow the product, they hand the product off, but they never actually touch the money that's involved in any of these transactions. Yeah. So the people that are arrested when they're present at some of these raids or when search warrants are executed, they're not the higher level people involved in these organizations. They're not the people who are doing the coordinating. They're not the people who are the primary benefactors. A lot of them are victims themselves. And even, you know, despite that, they get very low bail. They're bailed out usually within 24 hours and they are never going to be seen again. You know, we've got some upcoming court dates over the next 6 months that we're monitoring, and it's very unlikely that any of these individuals show up for their court dates.
Surprise. Well, there's another troubling angle of these operations that is sort of just coming to be fully understood, and that is that some of these operations are not necessarily run just for profit or revenue as a product to sell, but also are serving as money laundering operations that now these Chinese criminal enterprises have become the new money launderers for the Mexican drug cartels who are making money hand over fist off of human smuggling, human trafficking, and drug trafficking operations. And they need to do something with the money. So they are turning it over to these Chinese groups to purchase real estate to actually launder the Mexican cartel money. That's coming to light in some cases that have cropped up in other parts of the country. And it is also a pretty scary thing to contemplate, you know, how these massive organizations are working together and have been able to enrich themselves, in part because our borders are just wide open and they're able to move their operatives in. They're able to move their workers in without much fear of law enforcement. And they're picking these rural areas, whether it's rural Maine or, you know, now we know also some in Indian country as well, out west, particularly Montana, where the cartels are operating and causing major problems in these communities. So, you know, this is one consequence of shutting down interior immigration enforcement, which would be a good tool to use against these operations, and also not shutting down the border. So how do you think this is affecting Mainers and the communities that they live in?
Well, I think, you know, there are a number of ways that the presence of these criminal organizations is undermining the quality of life for the people of Maine. The first is that it's absolutely driving up the cost of middle-class housing because the properties that these people are looking for are rural homes, sometimes even mobile homes, farms, distressed properties. They're buying all the affordable housing. And if you look at the Federal Reserve Bank's chart of housing inventory in the state of Maine, it points pretty much straight down. So we're at a generational low of available housing in the state. Part of that is because during the government lockdowns and the pandemic, a large number of people from Massachusetts, New York, wherever, wanted to bug out of the cities and come, you know, live in Maine. So that took up a lot of the housing. But also in the rural areas, you have these criminal organizations that are buying up houses that, you know, maybe a middle-class couple looking to start a family would be able to buy for the first time. So we're pricing all of our would-be young families out of being able to own a home for the first time. That's one consequence of it. The second consequence is that regardless of how you feel about the morality or the wisdom of smoking marijuana or using marijuana, the state of Maine voted and the state legislature decided that it's going to be legal for adults to consume and you can run a business based on these, you know, cultivating this product, refining this product, and here are the ground rules. And Mainers across the state said, okay, those are the rules. I'm going to invest $500,000 or more of my own money to build a business, and I'm going to be passionate about it. You know, maybe I've been growing pot illegally all along. Now I get a chance to do it legally, but they've invested their own money to build a business. And what you've seen is the price of the product that they get has collapsed by more than half. And that's due in large part to the illegal competition that you're seeing. And so you're seeing some medical providers even go out of business and just sell their grows, cancel out. They just they're done. They're retiring. They're moving on. You know, I interviewed one particular guy for a documentary that we're working on, who's a Bosnia war vet, and he, you know, is tied into the veteran community, and his market is basically a medicinal grow, and he sells to vets with PTSD so that they don't have to be on the, you know, panoply of prescription medications that he himself takes because he has another job where he's not allowed to use the marijuana. Mm. So this is a guy who doesn't use marijuana, but he's an electrical engineer and he got his license. He started his grow. He wanted to cater to the veteran community and he's got this hugely sophisticated, elaborate grow. He's under a huge amount of scrutiny, high regulatory burden. He's got all these hoops he's got to jump through. And now he's just breaking even because the cost of electricity is so high in the state and the price of what he's able to get for his product is so low due to the unfair competition. So this is a guy who invested $750,000 into this business based on the expectation that, you know, everybody was going to be playing by the rules. And that's not the case now. And so he's going to be out, you know, his life savings effectively. Mm. If the state doesn't do something to prevent the unfair competition, he's going to be screwed. And one of his biggest cost inputs is his electrical bill, which is $3,000 to $4,000 a month. Electricity prices are skyrocketing in Maine for a number of reasons, including Chinese-made solar panels, wind turbines, that kind of thing, but also because of the huge amount of electricity that these illegal grows are using.
The demand is so high now.
Yeah, the demand for electricity is huge. I mean, this the property in Machias that I mentioned earlier was using 10,000 kilowatt hours a month legally through their meter. But then they'd also had somebody with a high degree of sophistication come in and wire around their meter, which is called jumping the meter. And it's you're using electricity from the grid without paying for it. So they were stealing an unknown amount of electricity from these places. And oftentimes these places also will blow a transformer. And so your average transformer is probably 10 kVA, and that's going to feed three homes on your street. These places will come in and they'll blow a 10 kVA transformer. You put in the 25, blow that. They put in a 50, you blow that. You put in the 75, you blow that. And every time one of those transformers is blown and replaced, the individuals responsible for overusing the grid and blowing it don't pay for it. Those costs are just socialized across all ratepayers. And ditto with the stolen electricity. Mm-hmm. The utilities just have, they add it to their stranded costs or their typical rate increases. So what they're effectively doing is stealing electricity or stealing money from everybody in Maine who pays an electricity bill. And here's another interesting detail that we're learning just over the last couple of months. These guys have learned that in the state of Maine, because it gets so cold during the winter, we have a policy in place where utilities cannot disconnect you for not paying your bill. They can't turn your power off from November to, I think, the 1st of March. They've learned that, so they've stopped paying their power bills through the duration of that time period. And then when the disconnection notices start arriving in March and it's time to pay the bill again, they'll just transfer the property to their uncle, their brother, their neighbor, their friend, whomever. And that electricity bill can't be held against the property as a lien. That, again, is another cost that is socialized amongst all ratepayers.
They know the system. So what are Maine lawmakers doing about this, if anything? What is their reaction? Presumably, they were all for legal marijuana businesses in the state and, you know, protecting Mainers and the way of life in communities. You'd think that they would be looking to do something about this problem.
So at the federal level, I will say that Senator Susan Collins has been excellent on this issue. She's written to the Department of Justice numerous times, met with DEA officials. She has flagged my reporting in particular to the U.S. Attorney of Maine. And I know, as a matter of fact, that her efforts have resulted in an increased level of federal effort here in the state of Maine. At the state level, though, it's very interesting. The governor of Maine, Janet Mills, has not said anything about this, despite now more than 31 search warrants executed on what appear to be totally related criminal conspiracies. She hasn't said anything about it. No official words, no pronouncements. Her appointed head of the Maine State Police, Michael Soschuk, has not said anything about this. Before I even reported on it to start with, I walked into the Department of Public Safety, which is the head of the Maine State Police, and I said, hey, I have information about a huge criminal conspiracy that is currently active in the state of Maine, and I'm going to report on it because I'm a journalist, but I don't want to step on your toes. If you guys are in the middle of some big active investigation, I don't want to, you know, publish this and cause these people to flee and screw up what you're doing. So I'm willing to come and share with you what I have and report on it in such a way that it doesn't mess with whatever you're working on. And they refused to meet with me. So you know, someone said, you know, we'll call you on Monday. And that was like 30 Mondays ago. And I haven't heard from them. And they won't respond to any of my inquiries right now. In the legislature, there were three bills introduced that would have dealt with this problem in some way. Only the legislative council, which is controlled by Democrats and allows bills into this current session, rejected two of them, accepted one. That bill actually failed in the House this week and failed in the Senate as well. Unanimous consent, no roll call vote in the Senate, but it was defeated in the House with an odd kind of vote. There were some Democrats who supported it and some Republicans who opposed it, but ultimately that piece of legislation was the only thing that would have dealt with these sites or given law enforcement new tools, and that failed. So it'll be another year or two at least before the state's able to change their laws in order to do anything about this. But at the municipal level, there is one very interesting case that I think may begin to plow the way for other communities to deal with the problems that they're aware of. And that's in a little town of Woodville, Maine, population 300. And it's about an hour north of Bangor. And their select board of, I think, three guys got together and wrote an ordinance that basically said the town's code enforcement officer can unilaterally declare any property a cannabis grow based on an inspection of the exterior of the property. Mm-hmm. And whoever lives there or owns the property has to respond or decommission it within 30 days. And if they don't, afterwards, a penalty of $10,000 a day is assessed so long as the code enforcement officer continues to believe that it's a marijuana grow.
Wow.
And that can become a lien filed against the property. So what this little town in northern Maine has somehow has more brains and courage than the entire state legislature in Augusta, because they've basically come up with a way to say, well, you know, if you guys aren't going to deal with it, we're just going to make it so cost prohibitive to do this activity that your power's going to get turned off until you pay us, you know, $100,000 after 10 days worth of not opening your mail. And one of the genius things that they did with their ordinance, it's delivered by mail. And I know through my investigation that these people, they don't check their mailboxes because, I mean, what are they expecting? You know, they get the occasional package from China, but they're not getting any mail other than maybe a gas bill. Exactly. So their notice that they're about to get fined $10,000 a day is going to sit in their mailbox for 30 days. And then those fines are just going to start racking up. And before they are even aware of what's going on, there's going to be a $150,000 lien on a property that they paid, you know, $65,000 for. So the town of Woodville, I think, is plowing the way.
Zoning rules and ordinances are some of the most powerful tools available to local governments to try to control problems like this. There've got to be other tools that they could bring to bear on this. Have you looked at that, Steve?
Well, one of the challenges that these communities face is we're dealing with very rural towns. Like the town I was just telling you about, Woodville, population 300. The nearby towns, mm-hmm. population maybe 500. They don't have local police forces. In some instances, they're relying on a sheriff with a headquarters that's an hour drive away, with a huge territory to patrol and a limited budget. Or they've got an agreement with a nearby local police station, which is a half hour away. Also, maybe three or four patrol officers active at any time. So the ability of these towns to have laws enforced by law enforcement is limited just by resources, personnel, and by the huge rural nature of the territory. So in terms of other ways to make life miserable for these illegal growers, there aren't that many ways available to them except for prohibiting the very kind of activities that they're engaged in.
Mm-hmm.
The legislation that failed this week would have had Maine adopt what's known as a Little RICO statute. 33 other states have them. They've been around since the 90s. It's a common tool for states to deal with organized criminal conspiracies where each individual crime may not amount to much, but when you treat it like it's a conspiracy, well, you've got a racketeering operation. And that's really what we're dealing with here.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
The legislation also would have required Maine's large utility companies to basically, when they see a property in Maine go from consuming 150 or 200 kilowatt hours a month for 10 years because Granny Smith has been living there, and then all of a sudden the property changes hands and it's consuming 10,000 kilowatt hours a month, it would require them to just send a report to the Maine State Police and say, hey, just so you know, this place is, it looks like they're smelting aluminum or something. They're using so much power.
Yeah.
And that wouldn't be, an indictment or a crime or anything. It would just be one clue that law enforcement could use to follow up on and maybe build a case for probable cause to obtain a search warrant or subpoena other records and maybe go have a look at what they're doing.
Not to mention, you'd think the utility would want to recoup something for all that stolen power that these operations are using.
There's kind of a moral hazard here, though, because the utilities aren't really losing any money. All the electricity that's stolen from them, they just recover through rate increases.
Yeah.
The other moral hazard here is that these power companies, they're seeing customers go from paying $250 a month for their electricity bill to $5,000, $10,000, $20,000 a month.
That's a good
So the
point.
Electricity companies are, in fact, making a huge amount of money off of these illegal operations. And even when the illegal operations stiff them on a bill or steal power from them, they recover it from law-abiding, tax-paying ratepayers.
Great. It's a great country.
Yeah. It's a hell of a place we've put ourselves in. And another way that this operation is really harming Maine, undermining our quality of life, is that these houses, because they're being maintained at 75 degrees to 80 degrees and 80 to 100% humidity for long, long periods of time, the black mold infestations are just totaling these houses. If Maine can ever wrap itself around this problem and deport every single one of these criminals or arrest, lock up every single one of these criminals, we're going to be dealing with a massive infrastructure project of basically rehabilitating all of these houses because they've been totally, you know, remodeled and destroyed. They've gone from livable middle-class homes to high-efficiency marijuana-growing operations. People who have little regard for the long-term future of the property. And there's a lot of jerry-rigged amateur electrical work and propane work that's being done at these locations. So
yeah,
even where
dangerous.
There's not black mold, exactly. There was one place in Turner, Maine, which is kind of in the central part of the state, where some people were eating at the Bear Pond Variety, having breakfast there, and they looked over and they thought they saw smoke coming out of the place. And so they called the fire department. Fire department kicks in the door and quickly realizes it wasn't smoke, it was steam because of the huge amount of humidity that was being generated by the illegal marijuana grow there. And what they encountered was this sprawling network of extension cords with heaters and fans and propane burners. The fire chief described it to me as a firefighter's worst nightmare, kicking in the door on a place like that, not knowing who did this propane work? Were they licensed? Who did the electrical work? Were they licensed? Is any of this up to code? What the hell is going on here? And you see that at property after property because they don't want to invite an electrician into nose around their business, so they're doing a lot of the work by themselves. Yet another wrinkle of this issue is that the plants, they can increase their weight of their final product by around 30%. By artificially boosting CO2 levels within the grow room. So they'll sometimes, like professional operations, will just buy canned CO2 and, turn on the nozzle and leak CO2 gas into the grow room. But with natural gas prices going down and natural gas more readily available, a lot of these places will just hang natural gas burners or use tankless water heaters to burn propane and convert it into CO2, which then the plants consume. So at a lot of these places, you're just burning natural gas, basically. You've got, the equivalent of 100 pilot lights all going. and sometimes they're, unsupervised for a day or two. Who knows what could happen if a pilot light goes out here or there. It's really amazing that you haven't seen one of these houses just explode. There have been a number of electrical fires, but one of the things that I've tried to explain to liberals is that I've calculated the carbon footprint of an average triad grow in the state of Maine is around 96 metric tons per year. So if anything, they should be concerned with the huge amount of global warming that these places are causing. But
I knew there was a climate angle. There had to be. I mean, there are 101 reasons that this is a problem that needs to be addressed by Mainers, their lawmakers, law enforcement, and even federal agencies.
We've talked a lot about marijuana and how, this has really been a big part of the investigation because these places are so easy to find because of what the activity that they're engaged in. But this isn't about marijuana. Like, these people aren't smoking marijuana. The marijuana is a means to an end, and the end is funding a criminal organization. And there are other facilities throughout the state that we found that are not grow facilities, but are stash houses, that are flop houses where, 10 or more migrants can live and can come and go. There are some areas in the state of Maine that have a distinctly military character, large shortwave radio antennas. The electrical workers who show up to change a transformer that they've blown tell us about, 15 or 20 military-aged men, cropped hair, surveilling the property, ushering them off of the property, stuffing two $100 bills in their back pocket and saying, coffee money, coffee money, coffee money. Hmm. There's something more than just, a little bit of drug dealing and growing pot going on here. And even the Department of Homeland Security says that some of this is fentanyl trafficking, some of this is human trafficking, but there's also national security implications here.
Yes.
Homeland Security says that. Senator Collins has expressed that concern. Senator Collins actually asked FBI Director Christopher Wray about our reporting, and everyone understands that there are serious national security implications to allowing Chinese criminal organizations to basically operate 270 base camps all over the state of Maine. There are defense contractors in the state of Maine. There are tech companies in the state of Maine. Corporate espionage, military espionage are real concerns, I think, for people who understand what exactly is going on here. Right. And it's not just about, elderly Chinese people growing pot in Garland.
No, these are, as you said, bases from which other Chinese operations can use as cover, so that's something we need to be worried about. That's why this is a bona fide national security issue.
I wrote a longer piece that people can read at themainwire.com, kind of responding to the Republican criticisms of the bill, where they said, this infringes on the constitutional rights that people have, your 14th Amendment right to equal protection. And I said, okay, well, that's an interesting theory. Let's play that out. Should we allow Chinese nationals to buy up every single piece of property around the Maine State Police headquarters and around Bath Iron Works? Should we allow that? Because that's the argument that you're making, is that if they come in with enough money, they should be able to buy all the property surrounding these sensitive locations. Should we allow them to buy all of the property around Unum or WEX or any of the tech companies here, and use sophisticated surveillance techniques to steal all their secrets? Because that's the argument that Republicans were basically making. I mean, there are some old military facilities that these this network has bought. They have compounds where they're growing marijuana that are surrounded by barbed wire and used to be Maine National Guard bases. The security threat, the security problem here is very real. And where there's $500 million, $1 billion, $2 billion to be made, it's only a short time afterwards that violence follows. And we've been fortunate here in the state of Maine that that hasn't happened just yet, but I do fear that it's on the horizon.
And that has happened at some of the other similar operations in other parts of the country, like Washington and Oregon and Oklahoma, is that it's inevitable that violence ensues. But thank you so much for your reporting on this, Steve, and for coming on the podcast to share this. And I highly recommend to our listeners that you check out themainwire.com. And there's a tab called Triad Weed and lots of other good reporting on the site, including coverage of how Maine has been handling the influx of illegal migrants. There's a lot of interesting material there. Really a pleasure, Steve. Thank you so much. And I hope you'll keep at it.
Oh, well, we certainly will. And thank you very much, Jessica, for inviting me on the podcast. And, I'd encourage people, if you're on X or Twitter, you can follow us at The Maine Wire. We're on Facebook in the same location. A lot of our stuff is pushed out there. And we are working on a documentary. It began as a mini documentary, has blossomed into a full-length documentary about the problem of transnational organized crime in the state of Maine. And we should have that available over the summer.
Great. I look forward to it. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jessica.
That's it for this week's Parsing Immigration Policy. Thank you so much for listening. This is Jessica Vaughn from the Center for Immigration Studies.